It's wonderful to be here. I was kind of wishing that I could be here under more joyous circumstances. You know, anytime you have to go, sometimes you have to go perform a funeral, and that's not the best reason to be seeing people and to be gathered together with people, but sometimes that happens. And I've been to a number of funerals that in some ways were very enjoyable because I got to see so many people I hadn't seen in so long. But nevertheless, the purpose of being there isn't very pleasant sometimes. So I hate to have to be here on that kind of situation. But you certainly are having your share of weather up here as well. We don't get as much snow in Illinois. You have to consider yourself blessed to see it, not necessarily to drive in it or shovel it out of your driveway. But you know, down there we don't get to see that much snow. I think the first year we were in Illinois. Well, we have this year. I will take that back. But the first year we were in Illinois, we had very little snow. In fact, I was beginning to wonder if we missed winter or something when we moved, and you know, somehow we blinked and it was gone. It was cold. And it does get colder there sometimes because the wind comes whistling out of Canada and down through Minnesota and across the plains and hits us pretty hard in Illinois. But and the, you know, the icy conditions and all. But we don't usually have as much snow. And it's kind of pretty here. My wife's done most of the driving since we've been here, so I can say it's pretty. If I'd been driving in it, I might not want to say that. But we certainly realize you have lake effect here, too, that you know, tends to drop a lot on you. I guess one of the things I should probably start out with, not that I'm, and that is to apologize to you. I think in many ways, maybe some of our ministry may have failed God's people in some areas over the past months. Would apologize to you for all of us if we've made mistakes or failed to take care of the members the way we should or done the things that we should have done over the past few months. And I thought I'd begin with that because I think it's something that needs to be done in terms of apologizing and realizing that we may have failed God's people in some ways. I'm really sorry that that's the case. So I hope in many ways that you'll pray that all repent and seek God, and that this will become a, something hopeful in the long run, rather than something to look back on and regret. I know that division is something that's never fun. It is never pleasant. It is never something that should be, but it happens, sadly. And that's what I'm thinking about in terms of how God deals with us as human beings. If, by the way, before I forget, if you should need to get a hold of me, if you want to ask a question, if you want to reach us by email or phone, I can give you a phone number and an email address if you want to reach us for about something. My cell phone is 309-620-3937. It's 309-620-3937 if you should need to reach me by phone on the cell phone. And my email address is a typical UCG ministerial address. It's Ken_Graham. Ken_Graham, and Graham is like Graham crackers, G-R-A-H-A-M, @UCG.org. So it's pretty easy to get to most of the ministry. If you know the last part of the email address, all you have to know is do they use their full name, full first name, or part of their first name, or that kind of thing. Let me know if I can answer questions. I usually try to go to somebody in the administration or somebody on the council to try to get answers. If there's, you know, technical questions you have about some of the things that have happened or what's going on, I'd be glad to try to get some answers for you. I had some interesting conversations with Bob Barron, who is one of the council members who's the head of the doctrinal committee. And we've talked at length on mostly on email. As far as communication, so I try to go right to the horse's mouth and get an answer for people as best I can. So let me begin today by asking a question. How do we prevent splintering? How do we prevent factions? Or how do we prevent division in the church? And to that question, you might say, well, isn't it a little late? Haven't the horses already gotten out of the barn? Or hasn't this already happened? Or you might say, well, is the ministry that started this, why don't they answer that question, that started this whole thing? And you may have a point in that regard. But another question we might ask is, or another way to put it, that is of benefit to each of us, is how can we prevent Satan from getting a foothold in the church or in us individually, both now and in the future? How do we prevent that from happening again? One of the things that we sometimes forget is that when Satan is around, and he wishes to attack the church, and as long as human beings are its leaders, he will introduce splits. He will introduce divisions. That's part of what he does. He's very good at what he does, and if he finds a tool that works, he's going to keep using it. That's just what he does. I want to go over and take a look at what the Apostle Paul says about it, because Paul tells us it's going to continue. And sometimes we don't realize that what he's saying is that it will continue to happen. It's not pleasant. We sure wish it wouldn't. And we'd like for it not to happen. And that's what I want to talk about today a little bit, is how do we slow it down or prevent it or reduce its effect, I guess, as best we can as Christians. 1 Corinthians 11 is where I want to go. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 18. 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 18. Paul says here, for first of all, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you. And in part, I believe it. For there must also be factions among you, that those who are approved may be recognized among you. Paul gives one reason for it. And I'm certain because God allows it, there are probably more than one reason for it. But Paul mentions one here in particular. And I want to point out a couple of things about these two verses. The Greek underlying verses 18 and 19 is somewhat interesting because the Greek words are very similar to our English words that underlie it in this particular verse. The word division in verse 18 is the word schismata in Greek, from which we get the word schism in English. Very similar in meaning. In verse 19, we find a verb that is in the present tense. Now, we have a past tense and a present tense and a future tense in English. I'm not sure if there's more tenses than that, but I know we have at least those three in English. And we also have the same thing in Greek. In fact, there are several other tenses as well in Greek, more than we have in English. But when you speak of the present tense in Greek, or you speak in the present tense, I am now reading from my Bible. That would be a present tense statement. I'm doing that right now. That's a present tense situation. When you say something in the present tense, it doesn't just imply that you're doing it right now. It means that it's a continuing action that's going to continue. In other words, if I say I'm going to read to you, that might be future tense if I haven't started. But if I've started to read to you and I am reading to you, then it's present tense and it's going to continue. And that's what Paul uses in verse 19 to show that there must be factions among you. It's going to continue, is what he's saying. And that, of course, is not good news, but it is something that God allows. Why God allows, I can't even begin to speculate all the reasons that God would allow divisions to occur. You got me. Paul says there's one. And that is that those who are approved may be recognized. I can speculate on one or two others for you and give you a couple of ideas. The second one may be that when we have a church split, if both sides continue to obey God and both sides remain repentant and both sides continue to follow God, then there will be opportunities in both sides for people to learn more leadership. there will be greater opportunities to progress, to develop, to become better Christians, to lead and to serve. To speculate too much beyond that as to why God allows it, I don't know. And I can't even begin to tell you that. But when Satan has a good tool, he isn't going to let go of it, and he will continue to use it. But believe it or not, God also allows Satan to use it in order to, as Paul says, that those who are approved will be recognized. Sometimes, you know, what happens when you have a split and you lose members and you lose ministers? Well, some of us have to kind of pick up and take over. And we sometimes have to do things we haven't had to do before. And sometimes we have to serve in ways we haven't served before. And sometimes we learn how to do more than we've been doing. So yes, as unpleasant and as terrible as it is, sometimes, I'm sure to God, there is benefit. And that's one reason he allows it. And it's not, you know, it's hard for us, you know, having been through it recently, to see any good at all. And I understand that. It's hard for me to visualize good. But God does allow it. So that means in the ultimate, in the long run, somewhere along the line, there will be benefit. And it's not, I could sure think of some better ways maybe to, you know, have benefit, or some ways I'd sure appreciate or like a little bit better myself. But I'm not running things. God is. So he sees far more than we do. And as painful as they are, divisions and factions do have an ultimate purpose in God's plan. In verse 19 in the New King James, it uses the word factions here in particular. And the Greek word for factions is, again, a word very similar to English. It's heresies. Heresies. From which we, of course, get our English word heresy. And it's the plural in this case. So it's factions here is plural, and it's heresies in Greek. And it's a noun that actually means a choice or an opinion, a sect, a faction, a party, or, and this is the interesting one, distinctive news. Distinctive news, or distinctive, I'm sorry, not distinctive news, distinctive views. In other words, that you may have a different opinion than everyone else. Sometimes when we get a different opinion than everyone else, and we begin to attach our emotions to it, it becomes the truth, and it becomes the only way, and it becomes the only opinion that anyone can have. And we try to sell it to our friends and acquaintances and people we know as best we can. And unfortunately, that's part of the human psyche. Sometimes we take something and we attach so much emotional significance to it that it becomes us. And that's the only thing we can talk about. And sadly, that's sometimes where we get in trouble, because we allow our emotions to rule over our logic and our thinking. And sometimes that can lead to, if our idea or our thought or our concept is criticized, we can become angry and upset and sometimes even become bitter over it because our idea wasn't accepted. But those are emotional attachments that sometimes happen with, you know, people in all kinds of situations. But that's not what I want to dwell on today. The Home Office, you probably are aware of, has asked for the ministry to come down to Cincinnati next weekend, next Monday and Tuesday following next weekend. I always think of it in terms of weekends, because usually when we go for the GCE or something, a meeting down there that we go on for the whole weekend, including the Sabbath. Anyway, they've asked us to come down to Cincinnati for a conference. You probably heard on the 31st of January and the 1st of February. And I have some ideas I want to bring. They've asked us to bring ideas, bring some suggestions, bring some things that will edify. In other words, what direction do we take? Where do we go from here? How do we do it? What do we need? And everybody's bringing ideas from their areas, and maybe by some of the things that have happened in their areas, if they've got churches that are not being very well covered, how do we get somebody in there to cover those churches in terms of pastors and elders to take care of those congregations, and a lot of that's going to be discussed. In fact, they're going to discuss it in some roundtable discussions at by area of the United States. They'll have a western region, they'll have a central region, and an eastern region of the United States. And they will sit everybody down who's in the eastern region together, and everybody who's in the central region together, and everybody who's in the western region together, and say, okay, what have we got? Where are we at? What do we need? Well, how do we fill in the blanks on all the things that are happening? And some of those, I have some ideas in that regard. I think probably every pastor has some ideas of what we can do and where we can go from here. So I'm looking forward to the conference. I've got some optimistic ideas on what we do. I sent Mr. Aaron Dean last week a message. He's our treasurer. And I know he was probably already working on it, so he hasn't sent me any replies yet, and I didn't expect him to anyway, because he's probably pretty busy right now. I said, you know, one of the first things we need to have a conference like this to talk about where we're going is, do we have an estimate of how much money we have to go there? You know, where are we going and what's it going to cost us? So I asked him if he could give us some kind of a quick rundown before we have these sit-downs. So we have some idea. If it looks like we're headed into increased money, or we're headed into decreased money, or we're going to remain about the same, give us some idea of where we're at. I personally think we're going to be probably a little ahead of the game in terms of finances. I'm optimistic. I think there's going to be a little bit more money than we might have thought we were going to have over the next 6 months to a year. But, and then what do we do with, you know, then if I know how much money I have, I can say, well, we could do this, we could do this, we could do this, if we've got that kind of money. So I asked if he would present something on that, some realistic estimates that we could use. So I'm hoping that will kind of kick things off in terms of the conversations in all of the different areas as to what we're going to do. But as I said, I'm optimistic the work of God is going to go forward. We're going to do well. We have less people. It has always, God has always worked with small groups. He's always worked with little groups here and there right from the beginning, and he continues to do so. He always has. A year from now, I think we'll look back and we will be amazed at how much has been accomplished. Right now, it's hard to foresee that. It's hard to see it, but I've seen this happen so many times. In my association with the church over the last 54 years, I've seen so many divisions, so many breakups, so many people leave and whatever, that I always end up looking back a year or two later and realize that we did okay. We continued, and we continued to do the work of God. And that's what I think we're going to be doing. Satan has worked his way into the lives of many. And I've seen that, and I've seen many divisions come and go, but I'm very optimistic about this. I think we will be very pleased in a year or so about where we're going. But now let me get to kind of what I wanted to talk about for the sermon here. I've kind of given you a little background and some ideas here, but I was going to give you a list of things that we can do to prevent Satan from getting into our cracks and our flaws now and in the future. What do we do to prevent him from getting the upper hand? The first point that I have here that I want to list for you is we need to examine ourselves, not the other guy. Let's take a look at ourselves. Where are we? I've talked about others. I've talked about some faults of others in various past sermons and other things. I don't want to go back to that. I don't want to go back to the negative side of things. I want to talk about the optimistic and the positive side of things and some things to avoid in the future that we can do. Mr. Wearing a Sermonette was an excellent introduction in many ways to some of the things I want to talk about here today. As we approach Passover right now, one of our primary focuses, of course, is to look at ourselves before Passover. Look into our lives and say, what do I need to change? What about me could change or could be of benefit? How could I be of greater service to the church? How could I be a more loving Christian in what I do and how I approach things? And as we approach Passover, that's one of the things we need to look at. Paul makes another statement in 2 Corinthians. Let's go over there for a moment. 2 Corinthians 13. 2 Corinthians 13 and verse 5. And he exhorts us to examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. Examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you are disqualified? Paul wants us to look at ourselves, examine ourselves. You have to remember that each of us is in the process of conversion. And conversion isn't a one-day process. We do have what we call sometimes theologically the moment of conversion, where the laying on of hands occurs after a person is baptized. There is a moment there where conversion begins. But that isn't the end of conversion. That's just the start. That's the beginning, the receiving of God's Spirit. Then we lead a life of conversion every day from that point on. And we go forward, and we learn things, and we experience life, and we experience how to treat life and how to react to life and how to live life in the way that we should. That's what God intends for us to go through, each and every one. To be converted and to begin to follow God's Spirit and begin to learn from God's Spirit and to use it in our lives and how we live. We can only work out our own salvation before God. We have to do that. We have to examine ourselves according to the Scriptures. And there are lots of Scriptures to examine. And there are lots of things to change and lots of things to look at and lots of conditions to meet. And situations to obey. There are all kinds of things in the Scriptures to change. That's all part of conversion. And we look, what do we look to compare ourselves to? Well, we look to the Scriptures to compare ourselves to, don't we? That's where we look. We don't want to be comparing ourselves to other human beings and other men and following men or anything. We look at what the Scriptures say. What do the Scriptures tell us to do? How do they tell us to react? And there are list after list of virtues that are listed over and over again in the Scriptures in many different places. One of those lists is in 2 Peter chapter 1. If you want to go over there real quick, to 2 Peter chapter 1. 2 Peter chapter 1 and beginning in verse 7, I believe. No, it's verse 5. 2 Peter 1 verse 5. But also for this very reason, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, to virtue knowledge, to knowledge self-control perseverance, to perseverance godliness, and so on. And we see one virtue after another listed in the Scriptures to explain to us the things that we ought to be looking at. These are part of examining the self, comparing ourselves to that list of virtues. You know, what's going on? How do I compare? How am I living? How do I compare to what I'm reading here in the Scriptures and learning from? So we look at all these verses, verses 5 through 7 in particular, 2 Peter chapter 1, and realize that there is a lot to add to our character. There's a lot for us to change. There's a lot for us to develop. So the number one point here in keeping Satan out of our lives and keeping division out of our lives and out of our church is to be changing. Is to be examining ourselves, is to be looking at ourselves and saying, what can I do to make me less likely to be someone that Satan can get at? Let me give you a second point. So I've got 8 points here. Everybody always expects sermons with 7 points, but one of the interesting things about numbers, if you're into number or numerology, is that both 7 and 8 are numbers of completeness in the Scriptures. Sometimes we ignore number 8, but it's also a symbolic number of completeness as well. So if I've got 8 points, I'm still right in there. So I'm going to give you 8 today. Point number two is evaluate whether we personally are bearing the works of the flesh or bearing the works of the Spirit, God's Holy Spirit. In Galatians 5, verses 19 through 23, there's a whole section there. We always think of Galatians 5, 22 and 23 as the positive aspects of growth, the positive aspects of what God's Holy Spirit does. You know, the fruit of fruits of his Spirit. And I believe it's actually singular. It's fruit of his Spirit rather than fruits, which is interesting that it is singular in the Greek. All those things are fruit of the Spirit. But there's also a list before you get to verses 22 and 23. And the list is full of all the things you shouldn't have, all the things you don't want to have. All the things that we can compare to ourselves and say, do I do this? Do I do that? Oh, I hope not. And those are the kind of the hope nots that are listed in the verses before we get to verses 22 and 23. Those are also worth looking at. Sometimes we don't realize there are positive lists in the Scripture and there are negative lists in the Scripture. Things you don't want to do and things you do want to do. And we have to be aware that those are there. They're part of developing character too. Do we have the works of the flesh or do we have the works of the Spirit? And the Apostle John was very good at understanding human nature. Sometimes we look at the book of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and the book of Revelation, and we think sometimes John, and I will give you that John was probably the, how do I say this in a positive way, he understood Greek a little less than almost any of the other writers in the New Testament. And so his vocabulary is not real high. It's not like, I mean, reading Luke, you think somebody that, Luke had vocabulary, let me tell you. I have a real difficult time reading Luke. And then he understood Greek vocabulary. He used every word imaginable in his writings. But John is very simple. And he appears sometimes to us in English as being simple. I mean, all John ever talks about is love. Heck, how important can that be? Very important. Very, very important. And John understood that. He understood it especially in understanding human nature. And that's one of our biggest failings. And it's one of the most important fruits of God's Spirit that we can possibly have. And John understood it. But John also understood our failings as human beings, that we all fail, and sometimes we do things that hurt us, and sometimes we do things that hurt others. And unfortunately, in all that's happened in the last few months and years, we've been hurting each other. He gives a solution to that problem in 1 John chapter 3, verse 10. And he talks about the two causes of fruit. You got good fruit, it's the fruit of God, it's the fruit of God's Spirit. If you got bad fruit, it's the fruit of Satan. It's the fruit of the devil, as he calls it. So, whichever one is materializing itself says what's been going on. And John isn't just a light surface read. Sometimes we think John's really easy to read. I can read the book of John in no time. There's a lot of depth to what John is saying that sometimes we aren't fully aware of. I'll leave it at that, and I'll move on. There are emotions that we can get out of, or we can allow to get out of control. And they can produce the fruits or the works of the flesh if we as humans allow ourselves to do that, if we are not fully as loving as we ought to be. We can produce works of the flesh. And some of those we're familiar with. I think Mr. Waringer mentioned a whole list of them in his sermon out here earlier, too. We certainly want to let love, joy, and peace rule, but there are fruits of the flesh, too, that sometimes get out of control in our lives as well. Often our emotions rule, our actions. We don't want to, with emotions, you want to rule your emotions. You don't want to let your emotions rule you. And some people, unfortunately, do allow their emotions to rule themselves, which is not a good idea. You get in all kinds of trouble that way. We have to rule over them. And the most powerful of the emotions, of human emotions, are negative, believe it or not. Anger, bitterness, hatred. These are some of the most powerful emotions that human beings can express. And they are dangerous, any of them to have. We have to rule over them, and they're extremely powerful. You can, of course, have righteous indignation or righteous anger. Christ had it when he walked the earth. But we have to be very careful with those things. You can hate sin, but you don't want to hate the sinner. Those are things to remember. If there's wrong and dangerous, some of those emotions can get out of control and they can lead us in directions we don't want to go. I'm angry. I'm angry at what's happened to God's people. The damage that a division does to God's people. That's a horrible thing. I'm angry. I'm not angry at the people. I'm not angry at, I could very easily be angry at Satan for pulling it off, yes. But he's not a people. And we know what he does, and God tells us what he does. But we don't want to be angry with the people involved. We simply want to be aware that, there's much damage that takes place, and I hate to see it. Let's talk about a third point. Third area to consider, and that is repentance. And this is a good time of the year to talk about that. Get ready to approach Passover. We have to be in the process of humbly repenting before God, seeking Him out earnestly, seeking what God will have in our lives, how He would have us change, how He would have us modify our characteristics and our attitudes, and how He would develop the character in us that we need to have. And part of that process is for us to repent of what we are and to be willing to change. Remember how Christ cried out the night before he was betrayed. I believe he asked that this cup would pass from him, if you recall, when he said that. And he said, in the end of his whole conversation with his father, in Matthew 26, he made the statement, he said, "Your will be done. Your will be done." And that's something that each and every one of us need to say. Sometimes we say it, but then we don't let His will be done. But it's something we should be doing, and it's something we should be letting Him do in us. Often there are things that we don't notice that need to be repented of. Sometimes we don't realize that they're there, but they are. And here's where we need to ask for help in identifying where our faults are and repenting of them. Helping us to see ourselves the way God sees us. How does He see us? And what does He see about us? He looks at us and he probably wonders sometimes what's going on. And we need to look at ourselves that way too. And, we'll stand back and look at ourselves askance a little bit and say, what's going on with you, Ken? Where are you at? And we need to ask for His help in seeing ourselves the way He does. That's part of the process of getting ready for Passover every year. Passover season is a time to look more carefully, a little more deeply into our thoughts and into our actions. And that process isn't pleasant. As human beings, we tend to put it off. I know what happens to me each year. I start with the premise, and I try to start giving sermons in January. Sometimes I don't make it till February. I start giving pre-Passover sermons I try for January. Sometimes I don't make it till February. But at the same time, I really ought to be looking at myself that early if I'm asking God's people to look at themselves that early. And sometimes I don't. Sometimes I put it off and say, well, I still got 8 weeks. Or I still got 6 weeks. Or I still got 4 weeks. And we tend to put the unpleasant process of looking at ourselves off for as long as we possibly can. Because that's human nature. That's the way we're built. It's not a pleasant thing to have to look at yourself and see what's there. So we tend to avoid it. After we've asked God to show us how He sees us, we have a next step between now and Passover. And it's to make a habit. One of the things that I found that seems to work pretty well over the last few weeks before Passover is to take a look in the evening after I get done with work or whatever, you get home from work, whatever your schedule happens to hold, and jot down a note and say, okay, I'm looking at myself today. What was I not pleased with about myself today? And jot a note down in the evening. And if you do that day after day, for several weeks as you're getting ready for Passover, you will probably see the same things coming up over and over again. And if you're looking for what do I do to get ready for Passover, that little list will give you a real head start on the process of looking at Passover and examining yourself. And it's sometimes you don't have to sit down for long periods of time saying, okay, what have I done this year? You can look down over over that list in a very short time, over a couple of 3 weeks, and look at the same things appearing time after time and say, okay, I think I know where to start preparing for Passover. I know what needs to be dealt with. Jot the note down. It will undoubtedly shock you after a month or two of notes. How come this stuff keeps appearing? Or how come these same things keep happening? And those are good things to look at before Passover. Let's talk about in terms of repenting and preparing, for Passover and changing. Let's take a look at point number four. Point number four is to choose your words carefully. Choose your words carefully. I find this to be more and more important as I get older and as we go through some of the things that we have gone through. I'm still not very good at it yet, but I find it to be more and more important that we choose our words carefully. If you remember the prayer of David, it's found in Psalm 141, verse 3, if you want to read it and go along with me. But David said, set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Keep watch over the door of my lips. Very important concept. Now, before Passover, anytime, really, in terms of where we're at, each of us. What we say is most often what we're thinking. What's going on up here? Because things just slide right out of our mouth as we're thinking sometimes, and sometimes we have to go back and say, oh, I wish I hadn't said that. I wish I could take that back or change that. And those things are always there, and they're always there to grab us. Occasionally we say something wrong, and we wish we hadn't said it and want to take it back. The Apostle James, in his book, makes the statement, for we stumble in many things. If anyone does not, I'm going to put my page here. I don't know about the rest of the verse here. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. Able to bridle the whole body. Boy, wouldn't that be something? To be able to control yourself perfectly. Wow. Wouldn't that be something? James 3, verse 2. That's where he says, for we stumble in many things. And indeed, there's been a lot of stumbling over the last few months. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man. I've always wondered about that verse. Could you not stumble in word? That would be amazing what you could accomplish, I think, or what any of us could accomplish if we didn't stumble. Each of us have to take care not to offend in our words and our attitudes or our actions. And sometimes there's been a lot of that done. That's a tall order for a human being. Especially in a very highly charged atmosphere that we've had in the last few months in the church. Emotion can cause words to spill out of our mouths before we can stop them. And those don't help bring people back together again. They don't solve situations. They don't bring peace. They don't bring reconciliation. Once you slip and things stumble out of your mouth, you hurt people. And sometimes you can't take it back. Whether or not we agree with one another's perspectives, one another's decisions, we have to determine to speak positively about our brethren, about God's people. And one of Satan's greatest devices is gossip, as was mentioned in the sermonette again. And gossip is run rampant. I realize that young people are really tied into the internet. They're very high tech in the way they approach things. But the internet isn't always the answer to everything. Sometimes I think people think that you can find any answer to anything on the internet. Well, you can find an answer to anything on the internet, I suspect, but I'm not sure that it's always the right one. You can certainly find an answer. And it can be, you know, it could be used for great good, but sometimes I'm afraid that it is used to spread gossip at a light, at the speed of light, I guess is just about the only way to put it. It can spread gossip that quickly. Another device is anger, and it is easily seen in the church today. It's a very powerful emotion, and it can get a grip on us even when we don't realize it has. Okay, let me talk about point number five. Point number five, and that is to be a peacemaker. Being a peacemaker is a difficult task. You know, we've heard it. I've given whole sermons on just peacemaking, and there's a lot to it, and there's a lot to learn about it. And there are good books on it that are out there, that will good biblically based books that will tell you all the steps of peacemaking, show you where to find the scriptures that support the steps. Know, in the Bible, to talk about how to be a peacemaker. It's a task. It's not just, oh, well, I'm a peacemaker. Well, you don't just get to be a peacemaker by sitting on your duff, so to speak. You learn how to be a peacemaker. And part of it is learning how to control that tongue. That's a good piece of it. That's a good part of it. And every one of us is probably engaged in the process of learning how to control the tongue. It's a hard thing to control. There are those who have and are and may yet choose to leave and separate from the United Church of God. That may happen. They have their own reasons for doing so. The United's policy over the years has always been that if people want to worship with us, they are welcome to come to worship with us in peace. That's one of the provisions we make. If they want to worship in peace, they're welcome. We want people to come and learn God's way of life. We want to be quick to extend the right hand of fellowship to anyone who we know who certainly wants to return or wants to come back. The right hand of fellowship should be there to help them, to encourage them. Ask for God's help to be part of the solution, not to be part of the problem. That's what we want to be. Part of the solution, not part of the problem. Strive to be peacemakers and Christian examples in everything we do and say, how we communicate with one another. Jesus Christ and the Father have been at peace for all eternity. Don't you think that's one of the things they want us to learn how to do? To be like them? I think so very much. Maybe even the individual corporate pieces of the United Church of God can be reconciled one day. We don't know. But we certainly want it to be possible. One can always hope and pray. We have to be aware of words and actions that may further polarize or drive wedges between us and between God's people. The division's already happened. Let's not further it with anger and with bitterness. Won't benefit anyone. If you're on the receiving end of angry or hurtful words, and that sometimes that happens, Paul gave some interesting counsel, and so did Peter. Let me read a couple of scriptures on it. There are two that are very famous and very well known. Let's go to 1 Corinthians as one of them. 1 Corinthians, I think it's chapter 6, isn't it? Yeah, chapter 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, he's talking about judging and all kinds of things in chapter 6. And in verse 7, he makes a very interesting statement. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 7. He says, "Now therefore, it is already an utter failure for you that you go to law against one another." In other words, if you have to go to court with your brother, you've already failed. You know, in some ways, you don't have it together. "Why do you not rather accept wrong? Why do you not rather yet yourself or let yourselves be cheated?" Why don't you let yourselves be cheated? Now look at that verse and realize, why do we not rather accept wrong from someone? That's the Christian way. Rather than getting up on our high horse and saying, well, you can't do that to me. You can't say that to me. That's the human nature side of things. That's the reaction to it when someone criticizes or hurts us or says something that's hurtful. But Paul says, why don't you just take it? That would be the Christian thing to do. Peter says the same thing. Let's go over to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 18 through 20. Peter says virtually the same thing in different words. 1 Peter 2, verse 18. Servants, be submissive to your masters and with all fear, not only to the good and the gentle type of master, but also to the harsh. And sometimes we encounter those. For this is commendable, if because of conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it when you are beaten for your faults, in other words, you're punished for things you justly did or did wrong, you take it patiently. But when you do good and suffer for it, for doing the good, and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable with God. It's, how do we say it, far more Christian to be abused for righteousness or for doing the right thing than it is to be abused for doing something wrong. You know, by the policeman who stops you for going through the stop sign or whatever. You know, anybody can be stopped by a police officer going through a stop sign. That doesn't make you a Christian. But, you know, when you take wrong from somebody and it's not really theirs to give it to you and you're not at fault and you take it as a Christian, then that's something. And God recognizes that. He knows that you have. And that's part of being a peacemaker, is sometimes taking wrong and just coming right back with good things, with comfortable things, with encouraging things for the person who's wronged you. Okay, let's talk about point number six. Point number six is to remember that God condemns division in the strongest words throughout the scriptures. In several places he does. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. I read a little bit from 1 Corinthians chapter 12 already, but there's more in chapter 12. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 25 and 26. Paul says again that there should be no schism in the body. There shouldn't be any split, but that the members should have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. Or if one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. And, well, there's a lot there in these verses. When one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. There's all kinds of thoughts and ideas here that go along with these verses. One of the things God hates is one who sows discord among brethren. That's a terrible thing, to sow discord. We don't want to be guilty of that. We don't want to be involved in that. But it happens. It's in Proverbs 6, verse 19, we're looking for, where it said, at least Solomon had the wisdom to write that down and to realize that that doesn't help anybody. And if you really think about this, showing discord or putting discord among people, all we have to do is mention names. If you want to sow discord, start mentioning names. That hurts people. That's gossip. And it hurts people very quickly. That's all it takes. Sometimes, in order to establish a case, in order to protect the flock, a pastor may have to say some things, and he may have to even mention a name occasionally. We don't like to do that. I'd prefer not to have to do that. But sometimes that's part of warning God's people, and you have to do it. At this point, there's no point in naming names. I don't want to go back and name names. I don't want to go back and examine what anybody's done. That's something we can do without at this point. we don't really know their intent. We don't really know their mind. We don't really know what they were thinking, and so we can't possibly impute motives to what someone has said or done. And especially, do we know that they did some of the things they did intentionally? We don't know that either. We really don't know what's going on in somebody else's mind. Do we know their motives? No. Not unless we actually, or not unless they actually came out and spoke about it and said what their motives were and why they did a certain thing. That's about the only way you can know what's going on in somebody else's mind. Most of the time, we simply can't guess about people's motives. So it's better to just leave names out of the picture. One of the sad things that I have found among God's people over the last year, people always ask me the question, you know, why doesn't United communicate better? Why don't we tell people more? Why don't we communicate what's going on more so that we know what's going on? Well, there's one very simple, maybe not a simple solution to that. It's found in Proverbs chapter 17. One of the things that happens, you see, when you send more detail out and more news, is to get more detail about what's happening. Oftentimes, names get mentioned, don't they? We don't want to mention names. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 17. And it tells us right here why the church doesn't communicate more gory details. And here's why. Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 9. What does it tell us here? He says, "He that covers a transgression seeks love." So do you bring up names and criticize? That's not love, is it? But if you cover up a matter so that people's sins and people's names aren't mentioned, then you're showing love, aren't you? And that's why the church doesn't give us all the gory details of every issue and everything that happened. But yet sometimes we always seem to want to know a little more. And it says, but he that repeats a matter separates friends. We don't want to repeat things either that are not beneficial or that might be derogatory toward people. So we don't communicate them because they're harsh and hurtful and they aren't loving. So why do that? We don't do that, or we try not to do that. But if you want that, you can go to the internet. It's full of all kinds of things, and full of all kinds of derogatory remarks and criticism and accusation, sadly. And that's why I used to say that I could avoid it. I unfortunately have to kind of stay up to date on a lot of things that are happening, not because I want to, but sometimes I have to read some of the things that come out over the internet, just so that I can kind of sort out where's this coming from. Is it based on any truth or is it not? And I'm forced to do that as a pastor because members keep asking me questions about, well, did you hear that this happened and that happened to so-and-so and this, you know, and all this kind of thing. And it's like, no, I haven't. Well, here, read this. And they'll hand me a pile of 5 or 10 pages of internet stuff to read. And I'm thinking, oh, I really don't want to read that. But I have an obligation to read it so that I can answer people's questions. And so sometimes. Boy, if I had a choice, I'd really rather not. Okay, Satan knows this. He would like to have us become involved in all the, all the muckraking and digging up of bad stuff about people that we possibly can. That's what Satan would like us to do. Find out all the bad things that your brothers have done. I'm sorry, I can't go there. All right. Let's talk about point number 7. Point number 7. Walk the path of humility. Walk the path of humility. Humility is sometimes a very hard thing for those who've been in authority to keep, to keep foremost in their thinking, to keep up front, to remember. It's interesting. It happens, I think, to everybody during the course of their lifetime. At one time or another, God will allow them to be put in a position where they have a authority or the power to make decisions, or they'll be in a position where they're over others or directing others or leading others, or whatever it happens to be. At some point, whether it happens to you at work or in school or in the church or whatever, sooner or later, almost everybody has an opportunity to be in a position like that. And one of the things that I find over the years and have watched over the years is sometimes when you have a position of authority, God will take it away from you after a while. Maybe not with his intent to take it permanently, just to take it away for a little while to see what your attitude is about having it taken away. The Apostle Paul, I think it's in Philippians, let's go over there. Let me show you what his reaction is to having this happen. Paul was traveling, doing all kinds of things for the work and for the church and reaching all kinds of people and doing all kinds of things. And then God slammed him into prison on a couple of occasions. Now, Paul, you have to think, if you're Paul, would you not be frustrated being in prison where you can't help God's people and you can't do what you've been doing? You would just be, ready to just run your fingernails down the blackboard because you're so frustrated at what's happening to you, right? And yet Paul makes this statement in Philippians 4, verse 11. He says, not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am to be content. And usually very shortly after Paul's been in prison, God let him out again. It's interesting. Can we be content without having that position of authority or that position of rulership or that place again? Can we go without it? Can we be content? And I'm thinking in terms of a parable Jesus gave as well in Luke chapter 14. Let me go over to Luke 14 real quickly here. I got a couple more verses here I've got to get moving. We have until 4:30? Okay. Ooh, all right. Luke 14. Luke 14, verses 7. Through 11 is a parable. I'm not going to read all of the verses to it. I'm just going to point it out to you, and then I'm going to skip on to something else here in a moment. But Luke, verses 7 through 11 is about the marriage celebration. People came to the marriage celebration, and people oftentimes sat in the chief seats of the marriage celebration, maybe at the head table, where the married couple is supposed to have themselves and their very close family and friends, and they sat at the upper table. And Jesus said, when you go to a feast, don't sit at the upper table. Sit at one of the lower tables. Don't take the chief seats when you go, because otherwise the head of the head of the marriage supper or the marriage celebration is going to ask you to, we had reserved these seats for close family and whatever, and we'd like you to have to sit back here with the rest of the group, and you're embarrassed, and it's part of an act of humility that when you come to one of those things, sit in the most humble place you can, and then it's better to have the guy who's directing the marriage ceremony come to you and say, well, we had hoped that you would sit up here closer to the family, with the immediate friends here. And Jesus gave that parable, and he said, that's one of the lessons in humility, is to be able to take the bottom place, to be able to take the bottom seat and not have it bother you. And that's part of what Jesus was trying to show to us in terms of humility. Philippians 2, verse 3, he says, let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem others better than themselves. Again, Paul talks about those subjects extensively. Now, point number 8, I want to get to it before I quit at least. Hebrews chapter 12. I went to Hebrews chapter 12 briefly, and I thought, oh no, he's not only going to introduce my sermon, he's going to take it. No, I was just kidding. Hebrews chapter 12. Some people don't believe Paul wrote Hebrews. I do. And I think Paul is making some really interesting stuff here. Point number 8 is to renew your spiritual vitality. Renew your spiritual vitality. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 11. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 11. We want to be in the process of renewing our spiritual vitality. If you're looking for a title for the sermon, I guess you could call it, Time to Re-Engage. Time to Re-Engage. And I'll talk about that in a second. Hebrews 12, verse 11. He says, now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. We have, in some ways, Paul speaking about chastening, and indeed we have in a division, in many ways, we've been chastened over the past few months. It's hurt. We've been hurt. The Greek verb actually implies a submission to the discipline and the authority as a son would to a father. That's part of the implication of the verb in this particular verse here. As Paul says this, no chastening seems joyful for the present. And as a son to a father, sometimes we're learning from our physical father while we're also learning from our spiritual father. And so many of our faithful members have submitted to discipline in all of this. And they've done, in many cases, done absolutely nothing to have deserved all of this pain that has come, been brought upon the church. And we've been trained by it, if we're willing to look carefully. Now, I want to, I just read it a few minutes ago, 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 18 through 20, I think, verses through verse 21. It talks about we're called upon to suffer sometimes. But after this, and after the chastening, we go to Hebrews 12 and verse 12, and we see Paul introduces the next step. What happens after chastening? What happens after you've been corrected? Where do you go from there? Verse 12. Therefore, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees. What's he talking about? Now, I've looked at those verses for years and wondered, what's Paul really talking about? What happens when you get depressed and when you get discouraged? You know, sometimes you start walking a little bent over and your arms are hanging down and you're not too excited about things, and you're kind of just dragging along, and having trouble. That's kind of what Paul's presenting here. When you're discouraged and depressed, your outward appearance often appears that way. Your hands and your arms are hanging down because your hands aren't active; they aren't doing things. The Bible uses the hands as the symbol of what men do. If you're an active person, your hands are busy. You're doing things. They're symbolic of what we do. The eyes, by God, are symbolic of what we see. The ears are symbolic of what we hear. The feet are symbolic of where we go, how we carry out our lives, how we walk, how we run, or how we actively participate in life. Well, the hands are what we do things with. And we need to have our hands exercised in order to strengthen them. And these hands have been weakened through lack of use. And when we're depressed or discouraged or down in the dumps, we usually are very inactive. And that's when we need to re-engage. And I have to tell you a quick story. How many of you ever saw the movie Top Gun? Anybody ever see that movie? Some people have probably seen it, some have not. It basically was, I think it was a career Navy pilot, and Tom Cruise played the leading role. He lost his reel. Now, Rio is basically a navigational and weapons expert who sits with you in an F-14. F-14 Tomcat is a carrier-launched fighter. It's a two-man setup. The two of them sit together, and the Rio sits behind you, and the pilot sits up in front. Well, he lost his Rio in an accident, and he could never quite re-engage, as they call it in aerial combat. Rio was killed in an accident, and he felt it was his fault, and he was depressed, and he just couldn't get back into engaging again in aerial combat. Until, finally, toward the end of the movie, one of his friends, or someone he knew, was engaged in combat with several MiG-27 fighters and was about to be shot down and killed. He then managed to re-engage and get back into the fight, so to speak, and get back into it. In many ways, it's the time for us to re-engage. That's where we're at right now. We've been through the tough times. It's now time to re-engage. the last part of verse 12, it talks about feeble knees. Same thing, similar to the hands analogy I just gave you. Well, feeble knees is, you know, you're kind of wobbly and unstable and you're not very strong. And then it talks about in the following verse, and make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather healed. In other words, if you've already got weak knees, you don't want to be walking on rough ground in the dark, not being able to see and not knowing where you're going to put your foot in the hole or that kind of thing. That's what Paul's commenting on. He wants us to reengage and to make some flat land for us to walk on, some level ground. And that level ground is part of walking in righteousness and learning how to walk God's way of life again and getting involved in what the church is doing. Re-engaging, onward Christian soldiers. We have all kinds of expressions to say, let's get up and get going. Let's get part of it. Let's get into the action again. Let's get at it, so to speak. Get into the battle. Verse 13, and make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but may rather be healed. Pursue peace with all people. There's a lot of things for us to do. There is a lot that needs to be accomplished. We want to get back on the path, on the way of life, back involved in God's church and in his way of life and in preaching the gospel and caring for the flock and taking care of God's people. When you're actively engaged in your job and in business, your hands are up and doing, and you're involved, and you're doing things. You're active. Our ministry certainly has decreased in number. Our members have decreased in number. So there's a lot more opportunity for you to get engaged and to become part of what we're doing and to become part of what the church is doing and where we're going. Paul said about division that those who are approved among you may be known. Well, this is your chance to be a bigger part of what God's doing, to be a better part of God's church, to be more active in serving others and caring and helping. Loving one another. Here's a chance to re-engage. Will you take it? Will you take the opportunity to re-engage? We all need to. Sometimes we fail to realize that that's what we need to do. Take a look at yourself over the coming weeks and months and say, okay, have I re-engaged? Have I become a part of what God's doing? I want to be there. I want to be part of. Take the opportunity to re-engage and be part of what God's doing. Let his Holy Spirit kind of ride you into doing what you need to do, showing you where you need to be led, what you need to do. Let's re-engage.